sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
When I first started this business, I ran from the camera. The camera scared me to death. You know, I was telling you in the pre-show, I did 7 keynotes over the last 2 days where I'm standing in front of 2 audiences where there were more than 2,000 people in the audience watching me on video. I'm terrified before I walk in because my world is standing on a stage where I can see people and interact with them. And when you're looking into the camera, making eye contact with the audience, I can't see them or anything. Like, I have no idea if everybody's asleep.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Jeb Blount. Jeb's the multi-best-selling author of books such as Fanatical Prospecting, and he's the founder and CEO of Sales Gravy. And in this episode, I talk with Jeb about, well, we were meant to talk about negotiation, much as we were meant to talk about negotiation, and his excellent book titled Inked, The Ultimate Guide to Powerful Closing and Negotiation Tactics That Unlock Yes and Seal the Deal. Well, part of a long story, we were meant to talk about that about twice before when Jeb's come on the show, but we always get sidetracked by something else. And as is our habit, that happened this last time we talked as well. We ended up talking about something else altogether. We ended up got into the ins and outs of virtual selling. In particular, we dig into some of the major elements of Jeb's latest book titled Virtual Selling, A Quick Start Guide to Leveraging Video, Technology, and Virtual Communication Channels to Engage Remote Buyers and Close Deals Fast. And Jeb shares some really excellent ideas on how to set yourself up to succeed in the world of virtual selling. So be sure to stick around to the end because this is another value-packed conversation. Now, before we get to Jeb, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Jeb, welcome back to the show.
It's awesome to be back. Thank you so much. I think you've had me back now in the last twice in the last 3 months or 4 months. So
something like that, yeah. Well, see, here's the thing. Now, you came last time, and we were going to talk all about your book about negotiation, and we didn't get to it because we got sidetracked, which is always a risk when we talk. And so nominally, we're going to talk about that book today. But you, my friend, write books faster than I can read them. So since that time, you've published yet another book, which I have to admit, I have not read yet. So we'll sort of save that and talk perhaps more in depth about it. But before we get to negotiation, let's do talk about your latest book because it's so relevant to what's going on. You wrote a book about virtual selling.
I did, called Virtual Selling.
Shock. How'd you come up with that name?
It took a long time. I worked hard on the shower. So.
That's funny. That's where I have all my great creative thoughts too. I even bought one of those pads that you can write on the shower.
I got one of those too.
I've never used it.
Me neither. I've never used it either. I look at that day going, you know, I've never written on that thing. So.
Well, I haven't even installed mine, so you're a step ahead of me. So, all right. So, virtual selling. Let's talk about that for a bit because we're in the midst of it. Again, apologize. I haven't had a chance to read the book yet. And I always enjoy your books. But so, is virtual selling different than selling face to face in person?
Well, it's a facsimile of selling face-to-face. And the idea is that we can create the closest facsimile of selling face-to-face as possible, because nobody's going to argue that a face-to-face communication isn't the best type of human communication. It's just not always efficient or effective in, you know, in the moment. So one of the things that I'm teaching people is a concept called blending, which is you take the sales process, you map it out. And this, by the way, is whether you're an inside salesperson or a field salesperson, and then you start taking a look at both your physical communication tools and your virtual communication tools, and then you map those into your sales process so that in each step of the sales process or micro step of the sales process, and with the right customer, that et cetera, you're using the right communication channel that gives you the highest probability of getting your desired outcome at the lowest cost of time, energy, and money. So back to your original question, is virtual selling different than in-person selling? It's still selling. And so the steps are the same and the motions are the same. The questions are the same. The way we do things are the same. It's just there are some, especially when it comes to video, some things that you need to keep in mind in order to deliver a better message, to deliver a better experience for your customer, and to make sure that you're not skipping steps in the sales process.
Well, so let's get into that last part, because is there a tendency when you're selling virtually to skip steps or assume that there are steps to be skipped?
Yes, there is a bad tendency. So one of the biggest problems that I'm noticing with salespeople across the board is that when they're on a virtual call, they are much less likely to ask for the next step. And let's call a virtual call either a phone call or a video call, because it's all virtual. It's just a facsimile of being there. For some reason or another, when salespeople, especially field salespeople who are transitioning from being in face-to-face, when they're on those calls, they really struggle with that close at the end of the call for the next call.
Why?
I don't know why. There's something.
Why field salespeople? I mean, I know salespeople in general have that issue, but why is it more pronounced?
Well, salespeople in general have that. I think that, you know, if you're a inside rep, we all have that natural problem. But if you're an inside rep, you are always selling virtually anyway, almost always by the phone. So your sales leaders are coaching you constantly to don't get to the end of the call and not ask. But with field reps, a lot of field reps just weren't used to doing like real sales calls in a virtual environment. So they just weren't used to it. And they just get, I think it's the vulnerability that they feel when they're on a virtual call doing something that they're not accustomed to, because they feel like a part of their sight's been taken away from them, and they just freeze. And there's something about that closing on a virtual call where they just feel like maybe they haven't earned enough trust or the relationship, or they just don't get that loving feeling that they have in person when they know it's the right time. And I see it in my own salespeople. Like we're at the end of the call, and a lot of times I'm waiting to see what they're going to do, and I'll just, you know, I'll end the call and go, okay, I got my calendar out. Let's go ahead and get the next call scheduled. So with inside reps, so SDRs, for example, they're always going to be almost 100% by phone. I mean, they're not making video prospecting calls. They may be doing video messaging, to connect, but the phone's been their, you know, their primary tool. And to that extent, web chat. So with inbound leads, you know, a lot of inside salespeople are having to learn web chat, especially proactive web chat, where you're engaging someone on the website. Now, like with our web chat, we can make a phone call right in the web chat. So
yeah, it's a great tool.
It's beautiful. So they're learning those tools. And I watch inside sales reps on chat freeze up just like field sales people do on a video call. So it's just something they don't understand. Mm. They get petrified on web chat. I watch salespeople. I mean, if you were to take chat alone, that's the place where I see the most terror. I see people just absolutely shut down on chat. And I'm like, it's just a conversation.
Right.
So it's like I was explaining to one of my people who was having a hard time with them. Like, if the phone rang, you'd be having a conversation. This is just the phone ringing and they're not talking to you. But in any moment, they could push that little video button and they're going to be on with you. So you need to be video ready. I think with account executives on the inside, though, as we start pushing account executives, so my trainers and consultants are working with a lot of companies to get the account executives to start moving more into video. So I'll get two things. You know, a lot of account executives will do their discovery calls purely on the phone. And in a lot of cases, they'll do their demos where there's a screen share so that their customer is on essentially a Zoom call with them or a video call with them, but they're not on video. right? So the account executive, you never see their face. So teaching them when you initiate the call, they can see the full frame you. And if you stop to ask questions, you turn the screen off and you put you back on the video call, right? Yeah. And you put you where it makes sense. You put you in a picture in picture. And we see the same thing happening where we take account executives who are used to hiding behind a slide. And now they have to get out there. They start getting a little bit, you know, nutted up in front of the camera as well. So it's just basic human vulnerability. And I get it. I mean, when I first started this business, I ran from the camera. The camera scared me to death. And, I was telling you in the pre-show, I did 7 keynotes over the last 2 days where I'm standing in front of audiences. I had 2 audiences where there were more than 2,000 people in the audience watching me on video. I'm terrified before I walk in because my world is standing on a stage where I can see people and interact with them. And when you're looking into the camera, making eye contact with the audience, I can't see them or anything. Like, I have no idea if everybody's asleep. So,
yeah. No, it's hard to play off it. I miss that part, too. And I'm doing it virtually. It's tough. Not being able to play off the – yeah.
Yep. So – but you have to train yourself and keep doing it until it gets better. So I think that – I think one of the biggest things to help salespeople understand, if we just dialed it all in, is that your customer's experience when they're working with you through the sales process is a more consistent predictor of outcome than any other variable.
Yes.
And a lot of companies are really starting to figure this out now. I think that the pandemic it's the pendulum is swinging faster than I've ever seen before. I had a beautiful conversation with the CEO of a big tech company. And the one thing he was talking about is we got to differentiate on emotional things. We got to differentiate on our soft skills, on our relationship, and how we sell.
All right. So I'm going to stop you because this is something I was just ranting about to somebody the other day is, in the echo chamber of LinkedIn is, a relatively prominent sales thought leader, if you will, says, here's a big myth about sales. Yeah. You have to have relationships are important, basically. And I'm like, whoa, wait a second. This is coming up more and more, actually. It's like, why do people think that relationships are unimportant? And to your point, when you talk about the buying experience and the customer experience or their buying journey is the biggest predictor of success, that's based on human interaction.
Yeah.
And so, I know people get afraid of this idea that a relationship's a friendship, which is just complete and utter BS, as you and I both know. If you're connected with somebody, the definition in the dictionary for a relationship is the way two or more people or things are connected.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're selling to somebody, you're de facto in a relationship. I mean,
yes.
How can we just put this to bed? Relationships are part of selling.
It's a huge part of selling, and I think that let's stop and look at one thing. Okay, so let me just in every interaction you have with another human being, at either the conscious or subconscious level, they're asking 5 questions about you, the other person. Mm-hmm. Do I like you? Do you listen to me? Do you make me feel important? Do you get me? Like, do you understand me? And can I trust you and believe you? And if you check those questions off, it's very hard for people not to do business with you. And so if you think about it that way, like, that's the relationship. And the relationship on a one call close inside sales, you're going to build a relationship. And we work with companies, so you're building a relationship in 5 minutes. And all it is just, do I like you? I mean, did you ask me a question? Are you concerned about how I feel or what I want? And when you offered me a solution, were you nice? And if you're really nice and I want to buy, then I'm more likely to buy from you. But if you call somebody, if you really want to buy something and the person's a total jerk to you, you're going to go someplace else. So that's,
most times.
Almost all the time.
But here's the flip side though, of that relationship thing is explicitly people saying, and these are people you and I both know, saying, you don't need to be likable to be an effective salesperson. And you and I both know jerks who have done well in sales, but being likable costs you nothing. Why wouldn't you be? If you're trying to gain every competitive advantage, if every little thing makes a difference, why wouldn't you be likable?
Well, first of all, there are people who are jerks that are good in sales, but they're not jerks to their customers. They're just jerks to everybody else. Because it's just really simple. Like, people don't always do business with people they like. You can, I mean, if you're a glad handing, you know, charismatic person, and but you're like, you know, you're, as Larry Levine says, you're wearing an empty suit. Like you don't have, you don't have the goods to back it up. Like you're going to sell something, but eventually people are going to catch on that you don't really offer anything of value. So you got to be valuable to your customer. So you, I mean, you got to get that piece. But if you're the smartest human being in the world and you're a complete asshole, nobody's going to want to work with you. And they're not going to buy from you because people don't buy from people they don't like. So here's the thing about this echo chamber on LinkedIn. So the first thing, and I'm just going to be call it like it is, nobody believes that bullshit except for the people that are saying it. Nobody does. So because I've got a big company and we produce a lot of revenue working with some of the most prestigious organizations in the world. And the people that are running those companies aren't sitting around in a conference room going, you know, we need a new strategy. I think our strategy is going to be, we're just going to piss people off. Like, because
we're going to be less likable.
We're going to be like, nobody needs to like us. What I'm seeing, though, is that I'm seeing a lot of executives who get that. They understand it, but they've been really focused on digitization, like the, you know, that transformational thing, numbers and quantitative things, where that's been the primary place they focused. I'm just seeing them shift a little faster into that, because I think one of the things that's happened with the pandemic is we've had to adopt, like, digital transformation sort of, you know, rolled over as like a tidal wave in a series of a couple of months. So what would have taken 10 years to transform us, we've done it very quickly. And I think when you wake up to that and then you realize, okay, well, now we're communicating through all these different channels. Take chat, for example. I can show you really good chat where two people connect, even though they're not talking. Like you can see it happen in real time. And I can show you train wrecks with a transcript where the individual on chat talked over the other person. They weren't likable. They didn't listen to the other person. They just threw out their stock answer. And you can see the person on chat getting frustrated and then abandon the chat. Right. So, but that was a person who came to you, like they came to your customer. So we know that's true. The other thing is that science tells us this. So just go back to Antonio Damasio. He was a professor University of Michigan. We all know him. And his somatic marker study was, you know, made him famous. But basically he proved, like so many other scientists have proved, Daniel Kahneman's another one. Eichmann's another one. They proved over and over and over again that human beings are irrational and we make decisions based on emotions first and then on logic. How we operate. And I'll just give you a really quick, I'll just refute everybody who says relationships don't matter with one simple thing: New Coke. If you go back to the late 70s, Pepsi was kicking Coke's rear end because they were running the Pepsi Challenge commercials. People would walk into a grocery store. They would ask them what their favorite soft drink is. They would say Coke, and then they would sit down, and they would drink the soft drinks, and they would say, oh, I like this one, and they would reveal that it was Pepsi. Coca-Cola didn't believe it, so in Atlanta, Georgia, they brought in scientists, and they were running the Pepsi Challenge in their labs, and it turned out that the Pepsi Challenge worked in their labs just as well as it worked in the grocery stores. So they got together and said, we need to change our formula. So they did, and they created New Coke. And everybody who's been to B school has gone through this case study because it is the greatest marketing disaster of all time.
Yep.
So it wasn't until 10 years later that a scientist, and I believe they were at Berkeley, figured this out. They were showing people pictures, really fast pictures of things that were really nice, like fuzzy kittens, or things that were really horrible, like a horrible like train wreck where people were lying dead everywhere. And they were showing the picture so fast that you actually couldn't see the picture. Only your subconscious could see the picture. And they were basically asking people like how you felt after seeing certain things. So they were able to register that the optic nerve goes directly into the limbic system, and that people seeing those pictures, even though they couldn't register it consciously, could feel the emotion of what they were seeing. And they stumbled on a group of people that this didn't work with. And they figured out that with this group of people that somehow there had been some damage, so the optic nerve was no longer connected, so they didn't get that type of emotional connection. This is part of what Damasio did. So they basically ran the Pepsi Challenge with these folks. And it turned out that the people that had that connection, their eye to the emotions, when they could see the Coke can, they always picked Coke. When they didn't see the Coke can, of course, they would pick Pepsi because the Pepsi to the taste buds tasted better. But Coca-Cola is about Santa Claus and penguins and Christmas and, you know, and the polar bears and, you know, teach the world to smile and all those things. The people that had that disconnection, they always picked Pepsi, whether they saw the cans or not, because they were focusing and working on logic. So if you think about that, just in that moment, right, logically, Pepsi tastes better than Coke, but emotionally, Coke tastes better than Pepsi. And when the emotions are allowed to take over, what do? We pick what we like. And this is why organizations everywhere make illogical decisions based on how they feel. I'm going to give you one more example from my world. Mm-hmm. We were in the middle of a seven-figure deal, a really, really good company. It was a big deal for our organization, and we lost it. So we built really strong relationships with the stakeholder group as we went along to the point where it was almost a friendship. So they were kind enough to sit down with us. I mean, they really felt an obligation to sit down with us and tell us why we didn't win the deal. And that's always been one of my core drivers as a salesperson is sometimes I'm going to lose, but when I lose, I want the stakeholder group to hurt to tell me no. Like I want it to pain mm-hmm. them mm-hmm. because they like yep. me that much. They sat down with us and they said, here's the thing. You won the deal. You outsold everybody. The way that you guys did this was, it was like artwork. And you sold the way we wanted to buy your product. But they said, this is a really big deal for our organization. And everyone from the CEO across the organization, their eyes are on this. And we've never worked with you before. And, you know, you're a small company. And we just need to pick a safe choice in this situation because our jobs are on the line. But we just wanted to know that you won and we're going to give you some more business. So don't worry about that. We're going to work with you on this and bring you into the organization so you can earn that level of trust. And I said to him, I said, you know, I would have made exactly the same decision. In that situation, if you just looked at, they liked us more. They felt like we got them. We certainly made mm-hmm. them feel important. They were really struck by the way that we approached the sales process. And we won on everything except for we didn't win on trust. They even felt that our solution was better. Like everything that we presented to them was the better choice. But they needed to trust us because their jobs were on the line. That's not a logical decision. It's an emotional decision. And so, yes, the relationship mattered in that moment, but we didn't have the relationship that the incumbent vendor had of years and years and years of working with them where they had earned that level of trust. So in that case, their relationship with that vendor beat us, even though we were in a situation where we won truly at the logical level. So this, you know, this echo chamber of relationships don't matter. Like a lot of things on LinkedIn, and I know the person that you're talking about, they say those things because A, it's provocative. So they get a lot of likes. And I've learned a long time ago, you can't spend likes. So if likes were dollars, I'd be doing the same thing. But I think the other part of it is that, that people gravitate to that because it makes it easy for them. This is why Challenger, you know, was such a big deal, even though in most cases it didn't really work because mm-hmm. very few people could actualize the idea. And people loved it because it just took the, hey, you don't need a relationship here, right? You just need to go and tell people what they're doing wrong. Now, that's not actually what they wrote, but that's what most people read into it. And how people yeah. approached it, because that's easy. Like if I don't have to go like make you like me, build a relationship, if I can just go in and talk about logic, gosh, that's easy. Like building a relationship with somebody, and oh, by the way, doing it on a video call, it's hard. Like I've gotta be vulnerable. I've gotta listen. I've gotta step into it. I've gotta be a human being. That is really difficult work. But if you don't need a relationship, you need to like me, screw you. Here's the deal. You need to take it because I'm better than everybody else. Bye now.
Well, I think to your point is some of the people that make that claim draw the completely wrong lesson from their own advocacy for it, which is that they're actually very likable. They just aren't very self-aware about it. But I think this whole idea is that people are trying to eliminate the emotional side of things, which is just impossible to do, as you described through Damasio's work. You had another study he did where he found this, and you probably know about this, came across this guy, the emotional control center of his mm-hmm. brain had been damaged, and he couldn't make any decisions.
None.
Without emotion, he could not make any decision. He couldn't decide what to wear, couldn't decide what to eat, couldn't decide to turn left or right when he left his house, all those things. So, and this feeds into something else I'm sort of interested is, and where you come across is that in this, in your work is again, I'm finding that, yeah, people are training sellers. Yeah. They don't have time for small talk. You know, the people you're talking to, they don't have time to, you know, sort of these basic human things, but it sort of gets magnified because, you know, if you've got a group of stakeholders is again, one of the things science shows, and this has been known since the '50s, is that when you get a group of stakeholders and look at making a decision in a business, is they look at it at two levels. What's it mean for the company and what's it mean for me? Mm-hmm. And so if you don't think there's a relationship as important, then you're going to miss that whole personal level there.
That's right.
You really don't have 10 stakeholders. You've got 20 stakeholders in that case.
That's exactly right. They ask the question, do you get me and my problems? See, what we forget is that you're selling to people that are using other people's money to solve their issues. And they're asking that question, me and my company. And the me part matters. And even in negotiation, for example, you know, there's when we look at, for example, we use a discovery format, and it's just an acronym called SCORE. But the first two, the S is the stakeholders' criteria for evaluation. So what's the individual stakeholders' personal criteria, and then we look at the criteria for evaluation at the enterprise level. Because at the enterprise level, that's how the organization is deciding whether they're going to buy your company or buy your product. But the individual stakeholders, they each have a list. And those lists can be divergent in what everybody wants, especially, you know, when you're looking at a group of stakeholders that may even have different loyalties. And it's normal in the training world to lose a deal because you're working with a group of stakeholders and three of the stakeholders have worked with another company and they like that company. Like, they're just connected to them. It has nothing to do with the training material or anything like that. It has everything to do with the relationship that they built with them. It's brand loyalty, which, by the way, is irrational. Brand loyalty is irrational. So I think you're exactly right. And you can never disconnect yourself from the fact that there's an individual human being making the decision. And Gladwell's last book, by the way,
Talking to Strangers, yeah, good book.
When he was talking about how the judges, like when you blindfold the judge, couldn't see the defendants, and when they could see the defendants, how they made different decisions about bail based on what they could see. I thought that was like one of the most fascinating things.
That's scary.
It's scary, but again, defining and refuting anybody who says that relationships and connections and likability don't matter.
Yeah. Well, so glad I triggered you on that, because I've been triggered on that in the last couple of days.
I have too. I wrote for one of those posts, and I went and looked in the mirror and
me
said,
too.
Jeb, this is not worth your time and effort. Move on.
Yeah, I sent it to Alec and I said, what do you think? But don't post it. And he can validate that when he comes back in when the call's over.
Well, I'm glad you're in the same boat, because I've learned to just ignore them, because I just know that they're the only people that believe them, believe those things. And they're pandering to groups of salespeople who
are scared.
They're scared, and the truth is they're probably not very good at what they do, and this just gives them an out.
Well, that sort of leads to the question I was going to ask you, is because I did go through scans one person's book on virtual selling, and sort of the premise was that, hey, there's this like completely different set of skills that you need to have. And my reaction to that was, well, what you said earlier in the conversation is good sales behaviors are good sales behaviors, and you need them. And it's not like you can come up and be a completely different person with a completely different set of skills in a virtual world than you can meeting someone in person.
No, virtual selling is still selling. And that premise is just, it's, let me say it this way. You to create emotional connection with people in a virtual world requires that you pay attention to some different things. But it doesn't require that you change the way that you sell. You know, doing good discovery, delivering a great presentation and business case that connects with what the buyer told you, asking provocative questions. You know, one of the things that I'm able to do on a virtual call that's almost impossible on an in-person call is I've got one of these smart boards. So when I'm on a virtual call, I can ask questions and whiteboard and collaborate at a level that's much deeper than I do in person with a group of stakeholders. And then I can send my stakeholders a PDF of the notes mm-hmm. that we took on the whiteboard while we did it. So, you know, the tool just gives me a lot more dimension in what I'm able to do. But if I was there in person and there was a whiteboard there, I always get up with a pen and I whiteboard stuff with my customer. But the smart board's great because I can share it with them and they can do it at the same time. But advancing through the process and selling, and you know, and I just start the book off saying I'm not an evangelist for virtual selling. I'm not an evangelist for any type of selling. I'm an evangelist for talking with people. I'm an evangelist for building relationships right. and building connections.
Right.
And I believe that what's happened with COVID has made this the best time ever to sell. I believe that the young salespeople who are going through this right now are going to come out on the other side of this crucible way better than they ever were before. And the people that come behind them that didn't have this experience won't be nearly as good as they are. And I believe that it's forcing everyone to learn that we can communicate through an omni-channel approach, both synchronous and asynchronous. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it's about talking with people. At the end of the day, it's about selling. And virtual selling is still selling. The same principles. Everything is exactly the same, but we do miss a few things. So we miss, you know, we miss the whole picture. You know, when you walk,
we miss the body language. You can't really see the body language.
Well, you can on the telephone, but we've been selling stuff with the phone forever. So on the phone, like I always tell, you know, inside salespeople on the phone, it's like selling with, you know, blindfolded with two arms and a leg tied behind your back, because 80% mm-hmm. of, you know, of human communication is visual. I mean, 80% of the brain's computing power is computing what you see with your eyes. I mean, that all that you take in. So we know that to be true. But inside salespeople do just fine. They sell stuff over the phone all the time because they train their brain to listen to the nuance of the conversation. They get good at pacing themselves on the phone and asking good questions. So they shift and learn how to do that. Video poses a different set of issues where, you know, we've got to solve the problem of video fatigue, which means that you need to get your frame right. You need to get your lighting right. That means that you need to have a good video call set that's not distracting, but is pleasurable for people to interact with. It means that you can use tools like a whiteboard. So when you're taking notes and people can't actually see your hands taking notes, that you just stand up and take them on your whiteboard. I do it all the time. It's amazing. People get off the phone like, how can I do that? Teach my people. Because it makes them feel good. Because the stakeholder says something and I write it down on the whiteboard and they see it, all of a sudden they're like, man, that makes me feel important and significant that this person heard me. I'm using the same principles, but I'm accentuating it and I'm building it out. So on a presentation, salespeople learn how to pace and pause themselves so that they learn how to bring other people into the conversation by calling them by name. They have to be better in discovery so that they have the information that they need to say, hey, Andy, you know, when we were talking last week on our call, you said that this was really important to you based on what I just presented. Tell me how you feel like that's going to work for your organization. If you didn't have that information, then you're not going to be able to ask that question and bring that person into the conversation. So I don't see, to me, like I don't sell any differently than I did in person than I do when I'm selling virtually. It does take a little bit longer to build relationships. However, mm-hmm. the one thing that I'm able to do is I'm able to compress sales cycles like further than you can ever imagine. Like a good example of this, we did an almost seven-figure deal. That was a rewrite of a company's training program. We were writing it for their trainers. So they have, you know, almost 30 trainers. So we're building the leader guides, writing the program, you know, it's a licensing program for IP, but we're building it around mm-hmm. them. You know, we're talking about several hundred hours of, you know, of work. We have to be creative. Then we have to do train the trainer for them. So it's a really big deal and a really big deal for this company and a really big company. So it's a lot of money. Typically, it would have taken about 6 months to put one of those deals together just because, you know, you have a meeting and then 3 weeks later, you're going to have another meeting and then you got to go talk to this person. I mean, we're doing deals like that in 6 weeks now, but we're having three video calls a week. Versus what we would have done on a deal that size before is we would have gotten on an airplane, gone over there, sat in their conference room, spent a couple of hours there, come back, spent six more yep. weeks getting together. We're not having to do that, and customers are accepting it. But I'm going to tell you something. If you don't, like, if you think that you're going to sell differently, if you think those things, it's the group of people that saying you can skip steps. Like there's somebody out there telling people that they shouldn't wave and smile when they get on a video call. Like what kind of a moron would tell people something like that?
Well, I have a list actually. Yeah. I'll tell you after we're done.
Like, don't be nice to people when you get on a video call. But when I get on a video call, I wave at everybody and smile. And you know what everybody does? They smile and they wave back at me. Right, we just shook hands. It's awesome, right? So I'm like, you know, it's just this drivel. And it's pandering and it's wrong. And you know it's wrong and I know it's wrong. And the beautiful thing is most of the smart people in the world that are actually making money know it's wrong.
Yeah. Well, and the thing you talked about that I wanted to get back to real quickly is you talk about, you know, closing deals in a shorter period of time is, yeah, I wrote about this in my first book, which was there's just this oral tradition that's gone around in sales is like, you know, I talk to the customer on day one and there has to be this interval that exists before I go back, right?
Yeah.
And this whole period is putting the lie to that because it's not the case. It's never been the case, actually. But and sometimes if you're in a field sales mode, you know, it took a certain number of days before you got back to people. People want to make decisions faster than we've ever thought that they wanted to. Mm-hmm. They've always wanted to make decisions faster than sellers want to sell to them. I mean, my experience over decades. And it's like, were you prepared to serve that? And most sales organizations weren't.
Yeah. And it was, you know, and it was the field salesperson because I was there. I mean, you'd meet with them on Tuesday. So you set the next meeting for the next week. So if you've got a 90-day sales cycle, here's when you get in and here's how you keep it going. And there was some strategy to that. You know, there was the you would go faster or slower based on where you thought your competitor was. So you could probably take them off of their, but a lot of it was just travel. Like you come in and you're working so many deals and that section of your territory, you don't go to that section until Thursdays. So you were just naturally pushed off. But now, I mean, even, you know, there has been a move called social proximity, which is essentially, you know, you build territories based on how connected people are to other people, back to our connection, but connections don't matter. Right. And the nice thing about virtual is that virtual begins to break down geographic territories, although in local field organizations where people are making risky decisions and face-to-face matters and gives you a competitive advantage, you're still going to have geographical connections. But now, literally, you can sell anywhere, anytime. And that's just back to my premise. My job on virtual is to create the closest facsimile to a face-to-face conversation as possible. So I'm just teaching people, when you sit up at night and watch Netflix, my wife and I were binging a show called Away the other night ago, which is a fantastic show. We watched 3 episodes. We didn't want to go to bed. We want to watch the 4th episode. And we had to go to bed because we got to go. We have jobs, right? So, but we didn't get up off the couch and go, man, I got Netflix fatigue. What am I going to do about this? You know, but you spend a day on Zoom calls and you get off the calls, your brain hurts. And your brain hurts because it doesn't look right. When you watch a TV show, everything looks right. Everything's symmetrical and the colors are right and the lighting right. And they put a lot of effort in that because they reduce overall cognitive load when you're watching a show. So you have a pleasurable experience doing that. So I'm just teaching people, listen, if you're going to get on a video call with people, stand up, get good lighting, get a good microphone, you know, make sure that you sound good, get rid of the echoey room and then we're just teaching people the art of being on camera, not the art of, you know, of you need to change the way you're selling. Because if you go to my virtual selling classes, we're really not teaching you virtual selling. We're teaching you virtual how to, like, the technical aspects and human aspects of, for example, how to maintain eye contact on a Zoom call. Very difficult for people, but very important because eye contact is one of the things that we look to in face-to-face interactions that allow us to trust the other person. It's teaching them, how do you show interest by leaning forward into the camera? How do you position yourself so that if you're doing that rather than being in their conference room, you can create the same feeling that we do in person. I believe that in person is the best way to communicate. It's just not always the most efficient way to communicate or the cost-effective way. So if we can teach people that, we still got to go back and teach them sales skills, right? We still have all the issues of, you know, you got to prospect and you got to fill the pipeline and you got to get to the next step. But the number one thing is if people are getting on a video call with you and you suck on the video call because they can't see you because you got a bright window behind you, they're not going to want to get on the next video call. So your sales cycle is going to stretch out because they're avoiding you because you suck too. I mean, they don't want to do that.
Yeah, they don't do business with you.
No.
So one thing you said that you sort of ran through, and this is interesting because I hadn't really thought of this, and I don't see anybody else doing it. You said stand up in front of the camera.
Yeah, stand up.
Interesting.
Always stand up. I would never stand up. Like, you know, I grew up selling where, like, one of the first rules I was told is don't try to sell standing up. And what they really meant by that was don't walk into someone's business and pitch them while you're standing up. Get across the threshold into their office, sit down. But it was always in the back of my head, and that I would never, like, I wouldn't go into someone's world and stand up. It would be uncomfortable for people to do that. But on a video call, we all stand up. Everybody on my team stands up, and we've been doing it for years. And the way that I started doing it and discovered that it was I got better reactions from people was we started delivering virtual training in like 2015. And in 2016, we started getting better at it. In 2018, we were really starting to pick up a lot more agreements with smaller companies that just didn't want the travel costs. And we started perfecting virtual training. And in fact, I've got a new book coming out called Virtual Training Bible.
Of course you do. Is that coming out tomorrow?
Yeah, it'll be out soon. but it talks about the things that we learned along the way. And I remember the day that for me, it struck me because I didn't like virtual training. Like, I really hated it. It felt bad to me. I didn't get off the training calls feeling like getting the juice that I would normally feel if I went to a training room. And I just couldn't figure it out. But one day I'm like, I'm going to try standing up. So it was a really awful thing. I didn't have a stand up desk or anything. So I'd stacked like audio foam and cardboard boxes up on this really rickety sort of tower. And I put my laptop on the top of it and said a short prayer that the thing wouldn't fall off. And I delivered a training for a group of sales reps in a manufacturing space while I was standing up. And when I walked away, I felt good. And then when I went back and looked at the video replay, I was like, they felt good too. They were leaning more into me. There were less of them that were, looking down and being distracted by other things. The energy was better. It showed through the lens. And it took me another full year to get my trainers to start doing the same thing. And I'll still watch their replay videos and go, get off the stool, stand up. And now I teach salespeople to do the same thing, because when you're standing up, like if you should see me on video, you can see my hands, which is really important because when people can't see your hands because of the human negativity bias, what are they doing? They're thinking about why they can't see your hands, and they're usually not thinking it's a good thing. And I'm not talking about a bad thing like that, but if you can't see my hands are dangerous. Like, hands are deadly weapons. So you can see my hands. I'm always on a camera torso up. And then I can.
That's what I was going to ask. So, like, waist up.
Waist up. And then I lean into the camera. I can lean away from the camera. I can put distance between myself and them. And the horizontal and vertical lines are always the same. And everything that I'm doing in that moment is to try to create a more normal environment so that people have a great experience and that they want to do more calls with me. And in a lot of cases, they just get on and go, wow. They go, I mean, people are like, wow. Can you show me how to do that? And I'll even notice my clients begin changing their video frames after they get on a call with me. They start getting better at it.
They start imitating, yeah.
Because they know that it made them feel that good. Like, suddenly they were like, this looks normal to me. I mean, this is what normal looks like. And so if we can do things that reduce fatigue for our customer, then it gets easier. And by the way, Andy, we talk about video all the time. There are some times when video is the absolute wrong thing to do. Pick up the damn phone and just have a conversation. Like, I don't need to have a video call in this particular situation with this particular stakeholder. So you need to, be aware that just because video is hot, it's not the only way that we communicate.
Yeah, well, I think that there are situations where a certain intimacy is required.
Yeah.
And I believe the phone is a more intimate way to communicate than a video call.
It is. But I just think that if you can get good at the video calls, and look, we're investing. If you were to come to our studios, you'd be amazed at some of the equipment that we've bought so that we can have better video calls. And it's expensive. And we have one studio where we have about a $3,500 piece of equipment, and it sits, the camera sits into it, and it's basically a big glass, but we're able to project the person's face on the glass right in front of the camera. So their eyeballs are right in front of the camera. So when we're looking at the camera, I mean, literally they can see us and there's no gap at all. So there's no looking around or looking down. Really, really powerful, but really, really expensive. But when you can do that, so if you're an enterprise level salesperson, if you're selling deals that really matter, and you're a company, you should be investing in this technology for your best salespeople so that they have that ability. I wouldn't give that to, you know, a random SDR. But
no.
But when we're working on big deals and we want to wow people, we use those things. And listen, you know, the thing about wowing people emotionally, I always give the analogy, and I write about it in the book, that this is back in like 1992, 93, 94, but Microsoft PowerPoint had just kind of come out. And mm-hmm. I saw someone use a PowerPoint presentation in my company. And at that time, I think we had one computer for 200,000 people that had PowerPoint on it. And I was like, that is incredible. Like, I immediately was like, I got to have it. So I went to my boss and I'm like, you got to give me PowerPoint. Oh, by the way, I need a laptop. Now imagine 1993 asking for a laptop and you're just a field account executive. I mean, I'm just a briefcase carrying, knocking on doors. My boss looked at me like I had lost my mind. And I'm like, seriously, I need a laptop and I need that software. And they wouldn't let me have it. So I went and bought it with my own money. And then I went to Best Buy, which, you know, that was the place where you bought equipment at the time. And I think I dropped to like $5,000 on computers so that I could run PowerPoint. And I started using it. And I did get my boss to relent and allow me to rent projectors because, you know, projectors at that time were in suitcases.
Yeah,
and I started building my final presentations in PowerPoint. I would walk into people's place of business. I would set the projector up. Sometimes I was like I was a camel. I had the screen on my back, like I'm walking in, you know, and I'm like this massive, all of this equipment. And I would set it up and I would run PowerPoint and they would hand me money. Because they were like, nobody's ever done anything like that. They couldn't see it. And back then, you know, we'd have things, you know, spinning around in circles. But I even, like in 1994, I figured out how to drop video into PowerPoint and make it run even on those machines. And when you're running a presentation and you're dropping a video on a PowerPoint when you're running a machine, people sit up and look. And they would write, you know, they would send me, you know, letters and they would tell me later on, nobody's ever done a thing like that. That was incredible. So I used technology in that moment to rise above everyone else. Now, you know, you walk in with a PowerPoint, you're just like everybody else. So same thing's happening here. Everybody's going to get good at video, but right now the people that are adopting this and leaning into it and getting really good at it and learning how to blend it into their entire sales process. Again, there are some situations where you need to go there. Like you're selling, I got a client sells a big equipment, really expensive, like, you know, $500,000 machines into manufacturing plants. There's part of the discovery process where you got to go. Like there's no way you could do that virtually. So, but they're able to do a lot of their initial meetings or initial discovery meetings on video, and they're getting good at it. And they can do demos on video and they're getting really good at that. So they're shortening their sales cycles because they're using these tools. But the salespeople right now that lean into this and get good at it, they're the ones that are separating themselves. And we're seeing it in our own business. Like we get clients going, man, nobody did anything like that. Well, there were a bunch of talking heads and they can see that like we're putting on a production. And I'm like, and it just excites me to be able to go and invest in this stuff and get so good at it that we're creating this separation from our competitors and our ability to interact with people that I know that they'll eventually close. But in the short term, why not take advantage of it?
Absolutely. All right, Jeb, guess what?
What?
Well, we didn't talk about negotiation.
I don't know why. I've got the book right in front of me. In case you ask me something hard, I could look it up.
I only have like 50 questions about it, but we'll have to do it again.
Well,
see, actually, this is my ploy. Actually, is I had no intention of talking about it. This is just a way to suck you in to get you back on the show.
Well, I love it. I love anytime. I'm still ready to talk about and negotiate. The next time we're going to talk about, you know, the art of negotiating in a virtual world and, you know, and what you have to do.
Oh, yeah.
Can do that. But it's been a delightful conversation as always. I think I dominated the poor conversation this time. I'm sorry.
No, this was great. Great information.
It's your fault for lighting me up like a rocket ship with that we don't need relationships comment.
Well, I know I could count on you. So, all right. Jeb, if people want to contact you, what's the best way to do that?
Best way is go to my website is salesgravy.com, S-E-L-E-S-G-R-A-V-Y.com. For all the people that aren't from the South, there is no E in gravy, so salesgravy.com. And you can, if you want to send me an email, I'm at jeb@salesgravy.com. That is my real email address, so please don't spam me. And you can also find me on Instagram at salesgravy, Twitter at salesgravy, Facebook at salesgravy, and just look me up, J-E-B-B-L-O-U-N-T, Jeb Blunt at LinkedIn.
Yeah, you keep saying gravy. I'm getting hungry.
I know.
Especially from the South, because there is sausage in that gravy.
Oh, I love some sausage gravy.
Oh, okay. All right, Jeb, now I'm hungry. All right, as always, pleasure to have you on. And like I said, we'll get you on. We will talk negotiation.
Awesome.
But there's so much going on that we just had to talk about this. All right, thanks.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm ever so grateful for your support of this program. And I want to thank Jeb Blount for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you could also leave us a rating and a review, let us know how we're doing. Well, we'd certainly appreciate that. And you can do that all on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this episode is over. So thank you for your help. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at revenue.io.